much is sweeter than my sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading excerpts from Humor of a Country Lawyer by North Carolina Senator Sam J. Ervin, Jr. What I say about humor is laden with anecdotes having their origin in North Carolina. This is inevitable. North Carolina is the most joyous spot on earth and abounds with humorous stories. I sing without apology and with pride Chapel Hill's favorite song. I'm a Tar Heel born, I'm a Tar Heel bred, and when I die I'll be a Tar Heel dead. In my honest and unbiased judgment, the good Lord will place the Garden of Eden in North Carolina when he restores it to earth. He will do this because he will have so few changes to make in order to achieve perfection. A girl who was seeking a master's degree in the humanities at Oberlin College visited my senatorial office, informed me she was writing a thesis on Congress, and made many inquiries of me about the Senate and senators. She asked me what I did to ascertain how my constituents wanted me to vote on the issues. I confessed I made no inquiries and conducted no polls to determine their views, but, on the contrary, emulated my kinsman, Chief Justice William Alexander Hoke of the North Carolina Supreme Court, in making my decisions. Judge Hoke said, "When I want to know what the people of North Carolina think, I go to my office, shut the door, sit down at my desk, and consult myself." In assuring my inquisitor that my mode of operation was not as strange as it might appear to her at first blush, I said, "Some of my people have lived in North Carolina for generations. As a general rule, North Carolinians are homogeneous people descended from ancestors who came to America before the Revolution and assisted in the founding of the Republic. They differ little in their views concerning fundamental constitutional and governmental principles. I was born and educated in North Carolina. I've lived among North Carolinians all my life. I think like most of them think. When I vote in accordance with my convictions, my votes are pleasing to the overwhelming majority of them." I confessed to her, however, that I fortified my standing with my constituents with this threat: "If you defeat me, I'm not going to stay in Washington like so many defeated senators and representatives do. I'm coming straight back to North Carolina, and you'll have to put up with me in person." My record and this threat induced North Carolinians to keep me in the Senate until I voluntarily retired after 20 years' service. During this time, I encountered no serious opposition, had no campaign manager, and solicited no political contribution for myself. Although I had been a Democrat all my life and always ran on the Democratic ticket, I was not a bitter partisan, and the Republicans always treated me with kindness. My gratitude to North Carolinians for their support and encouragement knows no bounds.
Carolina, broken heart, wait, wait, wait.
When I enrolled as a freshman at the University of North Carolina in September 1913, I was assigned to an 8:30 a.m. class in American history, which met in a lecture room on the second floor of the Old West Building and was taught by Professor Daniel Huger Bacot, a descendant of the French Huguenots of Charleston, South Carolina. Professor Bacot had a dour countenance, and no one suspected he possessed a sense of humor. On Halloween, some mischievous students, who were bent on embarrassing the supposedly humorous professor, managed to lead a cow up the steps to the lecture room and tie her to the corner of Professor Bacot's desk. News of this spread abroad, and all of the members of the class were in their seats before the time scheduled for its opening the following morning. Professor Bacot entered the classroom and cast a fleeting glance at the cow, which stood beside his desk, quietly chewing her cud. After so doing, the professor said, "Young gentlemen, I'm delighted to observe that the intellectual strength of my audience has increased so much since my last lecture." He then lectured on American history for an hour without paying any more heed to the cow. Dr. Vernon Howell, Dean of the School of Pharmacy at Chapel Hill, was an enduring hero on the campus. Each generation of students in those days who witnessed the recurring defeats Carolina's football team suffered remembered him as the player who made a winning touchdown against Carolina's arch rival, the University of Virginia, about 1905. Dr. Howell kept bachelor quarters in Chapel Hill. He had an arbor behind his house, which was famed for its luscious grapes. At that time, all the mail coming to faculty, students, and townspeople reached the Chapel Hill post office about noon, and they gathered there to see what the day had brought them. One of my closest friends at Chapel Hill was Clinton Kelly Hughes of Asheville, who subsequently became an able member of the Buncombe County Bar. My story requires me to reveal a peccadillo of Clinton's. I cannot obtain his prior consent to make the revelation, because the good Lord called him to heaven years ago. Knowing him as I did, however, I'm confident he would not object to my story, either here or in the hereafter. Clinton and I were attending summer school at Chapel Hill. He had to repeat and pass a course which was prerequisite to obtaining the degree he sought. We met in front of the post office. I asked Clinton how the final examination in his course, which he had taken that morning, had gone. He replied, "Fine. It was easy. I'm sure I passed. I'm afraid, however, I'll be shipped for stealing Dr. Howell's grapes before I can get my degree." He had gone to Dr. Howell's arbor to purloin grapes the previous evening. Dr. Howell had opened his back door and called out, "Who's stealing my grapes?" And he had fled. On reaching his dormitory room, he discovered he had lost some letters addressed to him and was sure he had dropped them under the grape arbor in his haste. They would be found, and he would be expelled for stealing grapes. At that juncture, I saw Dr. Howell making a beeline for us. When he reached us, Dr. Howell asked Clinton, "Are you Clinton K. Hughes?" On receiving an affirmative answer, Dr. Howell said, "Mr. Hughes, a thief undertook to steal some of my grapes last evening. When I called out, he fled. I discovered that the same thief had previously stolen some letters addressed to you. After he fled, I found them under my grape arbor, and I'm pleased to return them to you." With that, Dr. Howell handed Clinton his letters, turned abruptly, and began to walk away. Clinton had been too flabbergasted to thank Dr. Howell, who suddenly spun around and called to Clinton, "By the way, Mr. Hughes, if you like grapes, come down to my arbor, bring some of your friends with you, and enjoy my grapes. I've never raised any finer." That was only one of the many instances in which Dr. Howell revealed himself as a man with an understanding heart. When I was a justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, my wife and I lived in Raleigh, and our daughter, Leslie, who was a first-year student at Duke University, often visited us on weekends. Leslie always made superlative grades as a student. On one of her weekend visits, Leslie was totally incapacitated by illness. When she was advised to take to bed, she declared she could not because she had to write a theme for delivery to her teacher in creative writing on the following Monday. I asked Leslie what the subject of her theme was required to be. She replied that the theme had to discuss the procedure or system by which an organization performed its tasks. "Go to bed," I said. "Your problem is solved. While I know that it would not be according to Hoyle, I will write a theme for you on how the Supreme Court of North Carolina performs its judicial tasks, and you can turn it in. I'm sure the recording angel will note your illness and drop a tear which will wash out any iniquity of your doing that." Leslie went to bed. I wrote what I deemed an excellent article on the procedure by which the North Carolina Supreme Court performed its judicial tasks, typewrote it carefully, and gave it to Leslie as she was returning to Duke. Leslie has always been most conscientious. Consequently, I've never been fully satisfied that she delivered the theme I wrote to her teacher. In any event, Leslie told me on her next visit that she had delivered the theme to her teacher and that her teacher had graded it 4- and returned it to her with this notation: "This is far inferior to your usual performance."
I want a sound just like the sound of Mary's dear old dad.
As a youth, I envied the satisfaction that tobacco chewers derived from indulging in their habit. They resembled contented cows chewing their cuds. During my student days at Chapel Hill, chewing tobacco was the most prevalent of the discountenanced habits of students. I soon succumbed to it. Under the tutorage of Coleman Hall of Webster, North Carolina, I acquired proficiency in accurate expectoration. As a consequence, I entered the Tobacco Chewers Tournament, which was then held annually in front of Old South Building, and won the highest award, a brown mule tobacco tag suspended on a long blue ribbon for accuracy in long-distance expectoration. Years afterward, my beloved classmate Ernest Lloyd Mackey asserted at a public meeting in Chapel Hill that during my student days I sometimes indulged in the lowest form of wit, punning. To bolster his accusation, he added that during a debate in the Dialectic Literary Society, he heard me make this statement to characterize my opponent's speech: "When an oration we expect, we get expectoration." When I graduated at Chapel Hill in 1917, the Yakety Yak, the annual student publication, contained a cartoon depicting me with my right cheek vastly extended by a hidden chew of Picnic Twist tobacco and engaging in a goodbye handshake with a being labeled Mr. Chawing Weed, who was warning me I'd miss him after leaving Chapel Hill. I have been missing Mr. Chawing Weed ever since I married. My wife exercised her authoritative power and compelled me to give up chewing tobacco. My good friend Thomas J. Harkins of Asheville, one time United States District Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, and afterward Sovereign Grand Commander of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite Masons of the Southern Jurisdiction of the United States, preserved his right to chew tobacco much later in life. Tom purchased an ornate cuspidor and installed it in his study at home. After dinner each evening, he would repair to his study and chew tobacco and read. One evening, he discovered that his cuspidor was missing. He called his charming helpmate, Miss Roxanna, and told her, "Dear, I'm missing my cuspidor." Miss Roxanna smiled and responded, "Yes, Tom, you've been missing it. That's why I gave it away today." The Alumni Association of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill chose me as its president in 1947. When Joseph Marion Spike Saunders, its permanent executive secretary, and I were making plans for the next alumni luncheon, which was always held on the Monday during the university's commencement, we knew we had a problem which recent Alumni Association officials had been unable to solve. Although they were seldom on the regular luncheon program, four of the university's most distinguished graduates, Josephus Daniels, publisher of the Raleigh News and Observer, John J. Parker, chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, William Rand Keenan, donor of the beautiful Keenan Stadium, and John Motley Moorhead, donor of the Moorhead Planetarium and founder of the Moorhead Scholarships, were always in attendance. Their many admirers among luncheon guests invariably called on them for remarks, and they invariably answered their calls. As a result, the alumni luncheon, which began at 12:30 p.m., continued for 4 hours or more, to the dismay of alumni officials and many others in attendance. Spike said, "I wish there was some way for the alumni luncheon to adjourn at a more reasonable hour." I said, "Spike, it's going to do that next time." "I don't believe it," Spike said. "The age of miracles is past." After the regular luncheon program had been completed at the next alumni luncheon, I did not give the admirers of any of our most distinguished alumni any opportunity to call on any of them for remarks. I stated, "I am happy to observe that Josephus Daniels, John Parker, William Rand Keenan, and John Motley Moorhead are among us. I ask them to stand at this time and take a bow." They arose together to mighty applause. Without waiting for the applause to subside, I struck the podium a resounding blow with the gavel and declared, "The luncheon is adjourned." Spike heaved a sigh of relief, smiled, and said, "The age of miracles has returned." While I was serving on the North Carolina Supreme Court, my daughter Leslie was a student at Chapel Hill. Her favorite teacher was Hugh T. Leffler, Keenan Professor of History and author of monumental works on North Carolina's history. One weekend, Leslie visited her mother and me in Raleigh and predicted that the university would tender me an honorary doctorate at its forthcoming commencement. She based her prediction on this circumstance. Dr. Leffler, a member of the Faculty Committee on Honorary Degrees, had entered the classroom the day before, stared at her intently, and said, "The time for commencement is approaching when universities confer honorary degrees on some because of their merit and on others because of the public offices they occupy." Leslie's prediction proved true. The university bestowed on me its honorary LLD degree in 1952.
Now my
Shortly after my retirement from the Senate, I accepted an invitation from Chancellor Farabee Taylor temporarily to join the faculty of my alma mater, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, as a visiting Keenan professor and to deliver lectures to law and political science students. While I enjoyed doing so very much, I experienced relief when my task ended because I realized that I had told the students everything I knew and would have been compelled to do some hard studying if I had tarried any longer. When my daughter Laura Powell was a wee tot, I asked her if she wanted half of an apple. She replied, "Yes, Daddy, give me the biggest half." As a former teacher of English in Concord High School, my wife sought to teach our children to speak correctly. She had difficulty persuading Laura Powell to stop saying "ain't." She repeatedly told her the expression did not constitute good speech, because there is no such word in the English language. Laura Powell finally confessed she had absorbed the instruction. She said, "Mother, I know ain't a good word because there ain't no ain't." Despite early deficiencies in math and grammar, Laura Powell had an exceedingly alert mind and was an excellent student. But she never aspired to recognition as a scholar. After her brother, Sam, made Phi Beta Kappa at Davidson, and her sister, Leslie, achieved the like distinction at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Laura Powell warned me, "We've run out of Phi Betas in this family." "That's fine," I assured her. "I want one of you to be dumb like your dad."
"You ask me, sweetheart, if I love you.
When he was the Democratic nominee for vice president in 1928, Senator Joseph T. Robinson of Arkansas spoke at Charlotte. "Politics is not a vocation," he said. "It is not even an avocation. It's an incurable disease. If it ever gets in one's blood, it can never be eradicated." I was born to a family whose blood had been corrupted by politics. My forebears had been immersed in law and politics for generations. I will not climb my family tree to prove this statement. That would entail the risk of finding some horse thieves hanging on some of the branches. I nevertheless confess that genealogy is fascinating to me. It teaches the truth that William Cullen Bryant enunciates in his poem Thanatopsis, namely, that they who tread the globe are but a handful to the tribes who slumber in its bosom. On rare occasions, research in genealogy unearths amusing incidents. Some of my ancestors lived and died in New England before the Revolution. When I did some research concerning them, I found an incident relating to one of them in the annals of Massachusetts. It indicates that he was Yankee to the bone in thriftiness. The record solemnly discloses that he was a joiner, or carpenter, by trade, that he made a coffin for himself, and that he used it as a chist for the storage of apples until he died and used it himself. My New England ancestors moved to Nantucket, became members of the Society of Friends, and joined the Quaker migration to the present North Carolina counties of Guilford and Randolph just before the Revolution. I've been privileged to make the commencement address on two occasions at Guilford College, the great institution of learning founded and maintained by North Carolina Quakers. At one of them, I was introduced by a distant relative, Robert Frazier, chairman of the College Board of Trustees. He told the audience I was descended from the Quaker family that bears the surname Coffin. At the beginning of my remarks, I stated that I was also a descendant of Quaker families bearing the surnames Bunker, Folger, Gardner, Gorham, Hussey, Macy, Starbuck, and Worth, and was collaterally related to the Hobbs and Mendenhall families. On the conclusion of the commencement exercises, a substantial part of the audience assured me that they were my relatives, if I had told them the truth about my Quaker antecedents. Despite my disinclination to climb my family tree, I will make some comments on my great-great-grandfather, Joseph Wilson, a disciple of Thomas Jefferson, who served three terms in the North Carolina House of Commons shortly after 1800, and a quarter of a century as solicitor or district attorney, of the vast judicial district that stretched from Mecklenburg County on the east through what is now Cherokee County on the west. Each of us is said to be the product of heredity and environment. If this be true, I may have inherited some of my love for humor and frankness from Joseph Wilson. As chairman of a committee of the House of Commons charged with the responsibility for preparing a plan to redistrict North Carolina's congressional districts after the census of 1800, Joseph presented to the House a bill implementing the committee's assignment. A Federalist member challenged the fairness of the bill on the ground that it gerrymandered the districts to ensure the election to Congress of Jeffersonians. By way of pleading guilty to this soft impeachment, Joseph said, "That was our objective. If the gentleman can suggest how the House can achieve our objective with greater certainty, I'll offer amendments conforming to his suggestions." While Joseph Wilson was serving as solicitor, counterfeiting was rife in western North Carolina, and the responsibility for bringing the counterfeiters to justice devolved on him. On one occasion, he persuaded the jury to convict a notorious counterfeiter, and the presiding judge sentenced the counterfeiter to pay an enormous fine. After the counterfeiter had paid the fine and left for parts unknown, it was discovered that he had paid for it in counterfeit money. Joseph may not have seen anything humorous in that event, but he afterward injected a little humor into the most solemn document he ever executed, namely his will, which appears of record in the office of the clerk of the Superior Court of Mecklenburg County. In it, he stipulated, in essence, "If I should have any property at the time of my death, which I most seriously doubt will be the case, I bequeath and devise it to my beloved wife." The Raleigh bomb scare may merit remembrance. During the off-year election of 1970, Vice President Spiro T. Agnew visited Raleigh to extol the Nixon administration and urge the voters of the Raleigh Congressional District to support the Republican candidate for Congress rather than the Democratic incumbent, Nick Galifianakis. Agnew and Nick were Americans of Greek ancestry. Nick was a colorful campaigner. When a constituent told Nick he had difficulty spelling Nick's surname, Nick responded, "Don't let that trouble you. I couldn't spell it myself until I was in the ninth grade." When another constituent told Nick he had difficulty pronouncing Nick's surname, Nick said, "It's easy, if you'll remember. It starts with a gal and ends with a kiss." At the time it was announced that Agnew was going to campaign in Raleigh, the State Bureau of Investigation, SBI, and Raleigh police received many warnings that there would be dangerous bombings in Raleigh when Agnew came. Although I deemed these warnings to be hoaxes begotten by pranksters attending the colleges in the area, the SBI and the police deemed them to be serious and augmented their forces for the days of Agnew's visit with a bomb demolition squad from Fort Bragg. At the time, I was traveling from one Democratic rally to another in North Carolina with my energetic aide, Rufus L. Edmiston, as my chauffeur. At the request of Larry O'Brien, chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and Nick Galifianakis, I went to Raleigh to help the Democrats counter Agnew's attacks on the party and Nick. The Democrats planned a big rally in Fayetteville Street near the state capitol. They roped the street off to prevent vehicular traffic during the rally and erected a temporary speaker's platform in the middle of the street. Rufus and I rode to the neighborhood of the platform just prior to the rally in an enclosed van which Nick used in campaigning. The van was parked with its doors securely locked, and Nick, Rufus, and I walked to the speaker's platform. After the rally, which was quite spirited, Nick, Rufus, and I returned to the spot where we had left the parked van and discovered, to our consternation, that it had disappeared. We soon learned from hearsay, however, what had occurred during the rally. The mother of another aide, Lacey Presnell, was highly skilled in the culinary art. She had cooked a large batch of cookies for Rufus and me, placed them in a big box wrapped in brown paper, and dispatched them to Nick's van by a courier, who was instructed to put them in the van. On finding the doors of the van locked, the courier left the brown package in a rack on top of the van. Shortly thereafter, the SBI and police discovered the brown package and immediately decided that it contained a highly explosive bomb of deadly power. Summoning the assistance of the squad from Fort Bragg, they drove the van with profound caution to an open field well outside Raleigh. When their instruments failed to indicate any bomb within the brown package, all of the members of the SBI, the police, and the bomb squad from Fort Bragg, except the most valorous of them, took shelter, and the most valorous of them hurled the brown package as far away as he could to determine whether it would explode when it hit the ground. It did not explode. Thereupon, they opened the package and discovered that it contained a large box full of cookie crumbs. On the advice of the SBI, the box of cookie crumbs was taken to the state crime laboratory, which tested them to determine whether they harbored any explosive matter. On learning of these events, Rufus and I called the SBI by phone and demanded the return of our cookies. The SBI rejected our demand, justifying its action by explaining that the cookies had been reduced to crumbs and the crumbs were not palatable because the state crime laboratory had impregnated them with a noxious substance in testing them for explosive ingredients. No bombs were heard in Raleigh during Agnew's visit, except the verbal bombs exploded by him and me.
Carolina. No one could be sweeter than the sweetie when the meets are in the morning, the morning.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast on our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.